From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Today is President's Day, and we thought we'd mark the occasion a little differently this year. George W. Bush is technically our 43rd president, but only 42 souls have held the office since 1789. Grover Cleveland messed things up when he was elected twice, but not consecutively. Of these 42 presidents, it's no secret that all have been men, and all have been white, which got us thinking, we know what Jefferson and Lincoln thought about race, both personally and politically, but what about the other 40? What commanders-in-chief would be considered white supremacists today? And who were equal rights advocates long before there was an equal rights movement? To answer these questions, I am joined now by the co-authors of American Politics and the African-American Quest for Universal Freedom. Robert Smith is a professor of political science at San Francisco State University. He joins us from the studios of Youth Radio in Berkeley, California. And from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters, Haynes Walton, a professor of political science at the University of Michigan. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with this, because you actually rated every American president on a scale. Let's talk about the scale. I know that there are five levels of criteria. Break it down for us in terms of how you rated each one of them and what these categories mean. Robert, let's start with you.
A white supremacist is a president who believes in the inferiority of African people, not necessarily a racist, but just a person who expressed that belief. Then we have presidents classified as racist, that is, those presidents who supported the subordination of blacks, racially neutral presidents, where there's nothing in the record that indicates their position on race one way or another. They were essentially silent on the issue. Then racially ambivalent presidents, presidents who on some occasions took positive actions toward blacks and on other occasions they took negative actions. And then the last category is anti-racist presidents, presidents who proposed policies, undertook actions to dismantle the system of racial subordination, slavery, segregation, et cetera.
How is it, Robert, that a president like Abraham Lincoln, let's say, our 16th president, managed to score on your list as both an anti-racist and as a white supremacist?
Well, he clearly had white supremacist views. He indicated on several occasions that he thought Africans were inferior to Europeans. And he was never in favor of equality for African Americans, but he was tenaciously against slavery. He thought it was morally wrong. So he was the first president to take action that led to ultimate freedom of African Americans. But as my good colleague out in Chicago, Lerone Bennett, points out in his book on Lincoln, he calls it forced into glory. President Lincoln was pushed into his anti-racist position, pushed by events. He would have been quite prepared, and he said this openly, to allow slavery to exist forever, if that would have saved the Union.
Haynes, let's look at some of the other first 15, 16 or so. And that list, as I look at it here in my hand, all of them are in the white supremacist category with two notable exceptions, John Adams and John Quincy Adams. What did they do to distinguish themselves?
One was father, one was son. And they took a kind of New England liberal position against the whole question of slavery. They acted, as you well know, in one of the cases involving Africans that captured a slave ship and sailed it back into the New England harbor, hoping to get freedom. It's Adams that steps forward and attempts to defend these individuals and get them their freedom and get them back to Africa and so forth. They take a different position, an absolute different position, than many of the founders in this early stages, because many of the founders were all from Virginia, and Virginia produced early on a long list of people who captured the presidency, and most of those people either owned slaves or went along with the slave system in Virginia.
Let's move on into the 20th century. Robert, here's my question for you. An interesting trend happens on your chart between World War I and World War II. Presidents Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, and Franklin Roosevelt register racially neutral. Not bad. You'd think things were improving. But after World War II and Hitler's reign of terror, Presidents Truman and Eisenhower both register as white supremacists, although Ike was also listed as racially ambivalent, and Truman, who integrated the armed services, was listed as anti-racist. What does this say about our country at that time?
Well, of course, the onset of the Cold War, and presidents began to understand that it would be very, very difficult. Even a person who had white supremacist views like President Truman began to understand that the United States could not maintain its stature in the world in the Cold War context if it maintained open, legal racial subordination. These were Cold War imperatives. You needed to dismantle this open system of segregation and racism. Otherwise, you would lose what they called the hearts and minds of the Third World. Many of the Third World nations, of course, were beginning to gain their independence. It simply was incompatible with the American notion as leader of the free world that you could maintain this kind of system of oppression, open oppression. In Truman's case also, he was in a very, very close election in 1948, and he thought he needed the support of African-American voters in the so-called swing states of the Northeast and Midwest. So he had both a foreign policy and a domestic political imperative driving him. Eisenhower acted very, very reluctantly to enforce school desegregation. He was opposed to the Brown decision, but again, he could not allow this kind of open defiance of the Constitution to be broadcast around the world.
Haynes, in the 35 years since President Ford, every president on your list has been at least listed as racially ambivalent, but no president since Jimmy Carter has been listed as anti-racist. And now we're talking about Reagan. It includes both the Bushes. It includes Clinton. How do you explain that?
Well, after Eisenhower, and Robert is clear on this, you had a situation in the South where the Southern states were essentially Democratic. But after Eisenhower, there was a question about the Republican Party, whether or not it was going to continue on as a real party. It was in real trouble. The pollster Lewis Harris, in fact, has written a book on this, Is There a Republican Majority? And many in the Republican Party decided to figure out how can we literally build a viable Republican Party. And so what they did was to develop what is called the famous Southern Strategy and the use of code words for African Americans and the situation surrounding the African American community. And this then gave the Republican Party a base in the South, which made it a substantial party and a national party. And being such, then its candidates embraced blacks as much as they could, but also decided to go after the South because it was such an open area, it carried so many electoral votes and all that kinds of things.
All right, let's bring us up to our current president, Robert. I'm going to direct this towards you. George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, both of whom sit in the racially ambivalent column of your survey. And sometimes perception is the reality, and the perception in the African-American community, generally speaking, I believe, is that the two are very different with regard to how they relate to the African-American community. But they are listed together.
President Clinton took some actions that were positive toward African-Americans, mainly in terms of a large number of appointments. But he was very ambivalent on affirmative action. He came up with this phrase, mend it, don't end it. But substantial affirmative action was substantially dismantled during the Clinton administration. And then, of course, he signed, under political pressure, a welfare reform bill that threatens even now to do enormous damage to poor black women and their children. Similarly, President Bush has made a substantial number of appointments of blacks to office. He took an ambivalent position on the Michigan affirmative action case. So in some ways, appearances to the contrary, if you actually just look at the substantive record, there is not a lot to separate President Bush, George W. Bush, from former President Clinton.
I don't know if you can answer this or not, but this is my final question for the both of you, Robert and Haynes. Who was, in terms of the criteria of your survey, which is racially based and legislatively based, who was the worst?
The worst was Andrew Johnson by far. Andrew Johnson succeeded President Lincoln and did enormous damage in dismantling the efforts to secure freedom for the newly freed persons. My second would be Ronald Reagan, who also did enormous damage in setting back the cause of civil rights. The best president clearly was Lyndon Johnson.
This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country.
His staff people came to him and said, listen, if you support any of these civil rights initiatives that King and others want, you're not going to win a second term. You're going to be unable to get reelected to office, and you'll lose a lot of what you want to do. And Johnson simply wrote a little note saying, listen, if you got power, what are you going to use it for? That was the only way he could beat back his staff and the pressures that they were putting on him not to do this 64 Civil Rights Act, 65 Voting Rights Act, and other initiatives that he took, like appointing Thurgood Marshall. He said, look, there's no need of having power, and you don't use it. And so Robert is exactly and absolutely right. Lyndon Johnson is in a class by himself. None of these so-called liberals from the rest of the country would have tackled that situation. Johnson did his own region of the country in because he believed in the equality for the minority groups in American society.
Robert Smith is a professor of political science at San Francisco State University. Haynes Walton is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan. They co-authored the book American Politics and the African American Quest for Universal Freedom. Professors, thank you so much for the history lesson.
Thank you for having me.